to measure somehow. I think it's good to, you know, even if you're largely offering yourself loving kindness, to add someone and just see what happens with that. And other than that, I think it's really okay. Yeah. I'm going to look at Insight Timer and see if you can do that. Okay, so the question was about, sitting with, say, the same benefactor or the same friend over a long period of time, or you know, rotating. Well, partly I sat with the same people for a long time because I was practicing in an intensive retreat. You know, so I had one benefactor for 3 months. And that's just the way it went. I had one neutral person for 3 months. And once it was introduced, I didn't get to the neutral person right away because for the first 3 weeks, it was just myself and a benefactor. And then there was the slower introduction of other recipients. So it took 6 weeks before I was also up to what they call the enemy there, or difficult person. So if you feel you're being rushed, here you are, you know. But it's like my goal is always, even in a 7-day retreat, is to try to kind of show the lay of the land. So should someone want to continue the practice, they have some idea of how it unfolds. So you don't have to do the same person for months and months and months. Some of it is going to be intuitive. And if you're not working with a teacher, it's going to be intuitive. Like, if this is getting really dull, can I juice it up by visualizing the person, by imagining them in a private plane, by, you know, whatever. And if not, you know, if it feels like your energy is lower, it's probably time to switch. You can always go back, you know. Because remember, simplicity will lead to more concentration, but something more elaborate will lead to more energy. You know, and elaborate includes moving your attention to someone else. So it's fine. You could do it. I just don't think within a sitting it's that good to keep switching, you know. And if you're up for it, you know, keeping the same person for a week, say, at least, you know, so that you could kind of see the dimensions of, you know, getting more fully present and so on. And for somebody, you know, like the neutral person, it is really useful if you can choose. I mean, they won't be perfectly neutral, perhaps, and people worry about that. They don't have to be perfectly neutral, but you don't have like a big feeling, you know, for or against them. And because you may find that there's no change in your formal practice as you call this person to mind, but there is a change as you run into them, you sort of want to have the same one for enough time so that you can just observe to see if that's your experience. So when I was in Burma, for example, I had the same neutral person for the whole time from, you know, say 2.5 months or whatever. And it was just, it was another meditator there. She was there with her then boyfriend, who was American, and she was from South America somewhere. And she left Burma before I did, but she stayed my neutral person. And then I left, and I was in Bangkok, and I ran into her on the streets, and I saw her, and it was like my heart just leaped up. I thought, there she is. She's my neutral person. So I'm sure she thought I was completely crazy. You know, I was like, oh, it's you, you know. Like. And then just recently, so this was 1985. So just recently I was in California, and I saw her ex-boyfriend, you know, who's still in that same circle. And we were having a conversation, and he brought her up, and he said, oh, remember so-and-so that I was traveling in Burma with? And I looked at him, and I said, she was my neutral person. And he knew exactly what I meant and what I was feeling. He's like, wow, yeah, of course I remember her. Like, I probably remember her more than you do. You know, so in that case, it's probably good to keep somebody for some length of time if you're going to the grocery store again now and then or something, you know. Yes? The dead benefactor, okay. I will comment on that. So, classically, one might undertake loving kindness practice as a method for a couple of different reasons. One is the growth and cultivation of loving kindness, which is the antidote to fear, which is a sense of connectedness. Another reason it was undertaken was just for the sheer depth of concentration that could happen. And that's all the way through, you know, moving from our normally scattered state to a more concentrated state, to a highly concentrated state, which include, this came out Friday night too, include these states of like altered states of consciousness known as jhana, you know, in the text. So for some reason the texts say, if you choose a benefactor, say, who's died, it will be more difficult to achieve those kind of rarefied states of concentration known as jhana. So it's better to choose a benefactor who's alive. So my response to that is I don't really know anyone who does loving kindness for the sake of jhanic experience. We really tend to do it for the loving kindness. And so, and I also don't even understand why the tradition says that. So I know many a person who offers loving kindness to a benefactor who's died. The question of the phrases is another question. You know, this is, yeah, well, it's embedded in a culture that believes very strongly in rebirth. You know, so it actually makes sense in that context. This person has died from the body that we knew, but they're somewhere. And so within that cultural context, it actually makes sense. And in fact, the energy that's said to be the most powerful way we can connect beyond the body, beyond time and space, is good-heartedness. So there's a form of metta, which maybe we'll do this afternoon. It's kind of a form of metta called sharing merit. The belief is that if you want to connect to somebody who's died, you do a good deed, like you offer a donation somewhere, or you go to the monastery and you feed people, or you meditate, even if it feels like your concentration is totally crummy, or you seek to learn, understand, you question, you study. These are all considered actions that produce a very positive energy. So within that context, you might say, in honor of your person who's died, go to the monastery, offer food for as many people as you could afford to feed. And then there's a sharing of the merit ceremony where you dedicate the positive energy to the person who's died. And they believe it, you know, that it reaches them. It's not just for your own comfort. That's the context. And, you know, so from that point of view, the phrases as exists are fine. And even if you don't believe it, if you can use the phrases as exist, just as a kind of offering, you know, without them needing to make literal sense to you, then that's fine. And sometimes people just can't do that, you know. It's too much of a struggle, in which case you change the phrases to however it will work for you, because you don't want the struggle. Either you change for your formal meditation, you change the benefactor to someone who's alive, or if that's not going to work or it doesn't seem right, you change the phrases, you know, to whether it's gratitude or, you know, just honoring them in some way. But, you know, there are many options in terms of doing that. I would never say, well, don't choose a benefactor who's died, because sometimes it's the most obvious and compelling choice. But you have to kind of see how it works. And I do, often you do sharing the merit ceremony anyway. It doesn't have to be based on offering to someone who's died. You know, you do it because we practice not just for ourselves alone. And so at the end of a retreat or the end of a day or even the end of a sitting, you might feel the positive energy that accrued and then just dedicate it. The question was about, or the comment was about, finding some difficulty bringing the awareness and the ability to let go found in formal meditation into day-to-day life. And it's sometimes in meditation that he'll look back and say, oh, well, I really held on to that, or I really reacted to that, or something like that. I think there are a few ways, and even before I talk about those, I also find that people tend not to notice the progress as much as the difficulty. So, for example, we might be getting caught up, and caught up big time, and caught up with the same slight provocation, but it's not lasting as long. You know, it used to last half a day, now it's lasting 2 hours. And that's sort of the way progress happens. It used to last half a day, then it's shorter before we kind of come back to balance. And then it's shorter and shorter and shorter. And it's real. You know, but those 2 hours really hurt. Very few people jump up and down with joy and say, oh, this used to last half a day, you know? But that's a huge change in the quality of our life as it continues on. So you're probably doing much better than you think you are, really. I sincerely mean that. So that's the background. But then there are just ways in which, there are two ways. One is, you know, I'm a strong believer in daily practice. I think, you know, theoretically we don't need daily practice. And in fact, one person I was teaching in New York, and somebody very charmingly said to me, a lot of younger meditation teachers than you, say we don't need daily practice. You know, you can just be mindful cooking, you can be mindful walking down the street or whatever, you know. What do you think? So in my dotage, I said, well, you know, I think that's a nice story. We can, and it's theoretically true, but is it actually going to happen? You know, the degree of intentionality we need to try to be mindful during all these activities is high. And it's like trying to do something the hardest way possible, which is usually a tendency anyway. You know, but if we could sit, say, 20 minutes a day, we then have a foundation or a platform in these other times, you know, to bring more mindfulness in. And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is what this venerable old Tibetan Lama high in the Himalayas once called short moments many times. Short moments many times. In addition to the, say, 20 minutes a day of formal sitting or walking, we do short moments many times, and they are short, and they're fun. It's almost like you just have to ritualize attention. So people, I mean, the most famous one probably is Thich Nhat Hanh's suggestion, don't pick up your phone on the first ring. Let it ring three times and breathe, and then you pick it up. So it's just like this little interruption of your usually crazy momentum. It's some space. I have a friend, Janice Martorano, who has a thing called the Mindful Leadership Institute, I think. And she calls them purposeful pauses. Very brief, but frequent, or at least repeated throughout the day. Every time your phone rings, you take a few breaths. I was teaching once in a financial firm in New York, and I said that, and I looked up, and I saw the complete panic on everyone's faces, and I said, well, for you, maybe just twice, you know, just like let it ring twice, and then you pick it up. So, or people have their computers make these odd sounds now and then, or people decide, you know, you decide yourself. What, you know, people tell me all kinds of things, like when I write the email, before I press send, I take a few breaths, and then I read it again. And I decide if I want to send it, or every once in a while, instead of multitasking, just unitask, just drink the cup of tea. Don't drink the cup of tea while you're checking your email, while you're on a conference call. you know, it's not going to take so long that it's going to just like be a meltdown, you know, for your to-do list. It's just drinking a cup of tea. But you can actually feel the warmth of the cup and smell it and taste it. So short moments many times will help. And then the other thing I'll say before we break for lunch is mindfulness of the body is the most ready tool we have, because it's the most concrete and it's the easiest to be aware of in the middle of like a lot of pressure and, you know, people around us and things going on, where, you know, to watch the beginning of a thought might be too fleeting, it's too subtle, but you can feel your body. And so there are also ways of kind of using your formal meditation practice to almost learn what happens in your body with certain reactive states. So then when it's time in conversation, you can, and you feel that very thing, you have a sense of like, oh, maybe I need a breath. So for example, I have a friend who would describe herself as someone who could never say no. And so what she did in her meditation practice once was she sat down and she started bringing up in her mind those instances where she was asked those kinds of questions, where she really should have said no, but she couldn't. And she felt what was happening in her body. And it was this kind of panic, you know, coming up. And, you know, this feeling like, oh, they won't like me or whatever it is. But it was very visceral. So that became her feedback system when she was back at work. And someone would ask her that very kind of question. And she'd feel that come up. That was her signal to say, I'll have to get back to you on that. She couldn't bring herself quite in the moment to say no, but she could get some space. And once she had some space, she could come back and say no. You know, so it's just like that familiarity with what's happening in our body in terms of the emotions, and it will help a lot throughout the day. Okay, so we're going to break for lunch. A joyous occasion, and we have some information. Did great, didn't she?
Yes.
Maybe I'll actually tag on to that because it's such a weird discussion. You know, when we were practicing in India, the emphasis was very much on the teachings being given freely, that you couldn't figure out a price. And we pay different facilities for room and board sometimes. When we practiced in Burma, we didn't even pay for room and board, because everything you needed was offered. So there were two meals a day. Breakfast was maybe around 5:15 in the morning. Somebody's job was to look at the palm of their hand in the morning, and when the first lines could be seen by the rays of the sun, that was breakfast time. And lunch was maybe 10:30 in the morning. That was it. But every morsel of food was an offering. And the culture was really kind of based on that generosity. It was when I was talking about merit this morning. You know, if it was your birthday, you didn't expect to celebrate by getting gifts. You celebrate by giving gifts. So maybe it's your birthday, so you go off to the monastery and you don't make the food, but you offer the money to feed as many people as you possibly can. Or your daughter's graduating from high school, or someone in your family has died. You go to the monastery and you offer the food, and then you share the merit of the giving with the person who's being celebrated or the person who's died. So it was just like how it was done. And sometimes in Burma, or a country like Burma, Sri Lanka, another example, it would be a family, sometimes it would be a whole village would come together to just make that offering. And it was just the way it was. And so we opened the Insight Meditation Society in 1976, and we didn't know what we were doing whatsoever. Somebody said, I think at our 20th anniversary, that the thing that amazed them so much about IMS was that it was created and was flourishing with no adult supervision whatsoever. It's true, except we did have adult supervision. We had a board of directors, thank goodness. You know, and I was just at 4 days of meetings at IMS. That's where I was coming here. And somebody was reminding us of the old days when someone on the board would say, you have to budget for depreciation. And Jack and Joseph and I would go, what's that? I don't know what a mortgage is, you know, like. And we charged $6.50 a day when we opened the doors. Somebody's father gave him a car. That's how we had a car. And we had nothing, you know. But we sort of established it on the principle that we would have to charge. That was clear. And yet the teachers still would just be there on a donation basis. They wouldn't get any of that $6.50. Which we needed. So, you know, it's grown and everyone's grown up. And the place is like this amazing place. And still there and flourishing. And it's still working on that same basis of the teachers actually don't get paid. Some of the teachers who are there for, we have a 3-month retreat every year. They do get some supplemental money because it would be impossible that they would get 3 months worth of income, you know, to cover rent or whatever they're paying back home. But other than that, you know, it's just still on a Donna basis. And it's so un-American, you know, it's one of the things I enjoy about it. It's bizarre. And it's sort of unbelievable, you know, that it's we and they have flourished, you know, in that circumstance, because it's not a culture. Ours is not a culture that prizes that. You know, you hear people want to appreciate something if they don't pay for it. Or, you know, many, many things. And so this is different. And there actually are not that many places in the country where it still works this way, because it's a process of people, you all understanding what it is. Otherwise, it can't work. And so we do appreciate it, and I appreciate that it can still happen because it's so revolutionary. So it's a little radical act in the midst of a very busy life. So that's, and you know, even the word, like, I know we all tend to fall into jargon and we use language not everyone understands, and it's very unfortunate. And like, if people come to Barry to sit and then they leave, usually people leave like their stash of M&Ms and, you know, like coffee and things like that. And almost always they leave it out for the next group to use. And there's a little sign that says Donna. And once I had a young friend sit a retreat, and she came up to me and she said, who's Dana and why'd she leave all her stuff here, you know? Like, and I'm, you know, perpetually hearing people talk about Donna without explaining what it is, or, you know, and it seems unfair to me that we just use these terms. But you did a beautiful job, so thank you. Okay, so there's something I forgot to say this morning that someone reminded me of, which was, I said, when we feel like an excess of energy compared to the amount of calm or tranquility that we're feeling, there are two things we can do, and I only talked about one of them. And none of you challenged me. I talked about soothing, like that kind of sensual soothe, like feel the breath as though your hands were in water, or just like put your hands in water and get that kind of, and structure and simplicity helping guard the concentration and deepen the concentration. So the other thing is to recognize that from within this system, from within this point of view, when we feel worry, we feel anxiety, we feel restlessness, we feel agitation, that is a similar imbalance. It's not considered bad or wrong or, you know, a clinical diagnosis. It's an imbalance. There's too much energy for the amount of calm and tranquility we have in our system at that moment. And so the other thing that happens is, based on a recognition that when a really big energy is trying to move through a tight, enclosed, narrow space, it's going to be really jagged, we try to create a big space so that the energy can actually move. So that's often very personal. for people. You know, you reflect on what helps you get a sense of spaciousness. It might mean walking meditation so the energy is actually moving rather than sitting. It might mean sitting for short periods, then walking, and then sitting, and then walking. You know, we tend to have kind of standardized schedules, but there's nothing sacred about that schedule. I also heard there was a monastery in Burma. I was never there, but I heard that the schedule was to start with 5 minutes of sitting and 5 minutes of walking, and then 5 minutes of sitting and 5 minutes of walking, and then maybe 10 minutes of sitting and 10 minutes of walking. It wasn't like 45 minutes of sitting or long periods, and I somehow never end up at those places, you know, but that's fine too. So it's like an experiment. Everything from people going out and looking at the sky, or if you're going to continue sitting there, maybe it's listening to sound, which is one of the very classic ways of kind of creating a sense of space. If you're doing loving kindness, maybe it's loving kindness for all beings everywhere, every corner of the earth, you know. And then it's just having the energy move in some more productive way. It's like channeling it instead of being run by it. And so, that's the second thing. Following the Dana talk, I'll just repeat there are four qualities that bundle together are known as the four Brahma-viharas. First is metta, or loving-kindness. Second is compassion. The third is sympathetic joy, or joy in the happiness of others. And the fourth is equanimity, or balance. And each of these states are described, is described in the Buddhist psychology as having what's called a near enemy, a far enemy, and a proximate cause. And I know this is familiar to many of you. The far enemy is the complete opposite of that state. You would never confuse the two. The near enemy, in contrast, is a state that's close enough, so you might get confused, but when you really take a good look, is really essential differences. They're very, very different. And the proximate cause is the is a near arising springboard. So it's something that if you put that in place, you will more likely get to the Brahma-vihara state. It's not the only springboard, it's not the only way there, but it's like a good one. You know, so the far enemy of loving kindness is aversion, which in some systems of the Buddhist psychology is both anger and fear, which are considered actually the same state, just two different forms of the same state. Anger being the outflowing, expressive, energized form, fear being the held in, frozen, kind of imploding form of striking out against what's happening, wanting to declare it to be untrue. And you wouldn't, that's why they say, you know, the Buddha taught loving kindness is the antidote to fear. It's the opposite. And so you're almost like replacing in your system the tendency toward fear with the tendency toward connection. The near enemies tend to be trickier. You know, they're more subtle, they're more confusing. The near enemy of loving kindness traditionally is attachment. Now, this is especially confusing in this day and age because of Western psychology and attachment theory, and attachment's like a good thing, and the last thing you want is a kind of, you know, insecure attachment relationship. Or it's all askew. And so it's important to know what the word means, because the words in something like the Buddhist psychological system are pretty exacting. You know, it's like it's one of those picayune systems where people have argued for hundreds of years about a word, you know. So one, attachment in this sense doesn't mean bonding, it doesn't mean that sense of nurturing, it doesn't mean that sense of intimacy or closeness. It really is a kind of control. You know, it's a clinging or a sense of needing to be in control. And that's why the difference is between a freely given gift and a gift that has all these strings attached. You know, it's one thing to give and enjoy the very giving, and it's another thing to give and really expect to be thanked in a certain way and be very dismayed if you're not, or to get something in exchange and you may not, you know. So that's why, and even attachment is not called bad or wrong or terrible. It's talked about as the root of suffering. You know, we cling and we want to be in control, and we will never be in control the way we want, and so we suffer. That doesn't mean we don't have preferences and we don't want things to be a certain way and we don't work for things to be a certain way. But that attachment, that clinging is like an extra thing. You know, it's usually very narrow. It doesn't provide a lot of options. You must not change. You'll say, okay. Or, you know, the season must not change. Or, that's not good enough. It has to be exactly that. Being on the New York Times bestseller list for a week is not good enough. It needs to be a year. It's like, okay. You know, your options are dwindling. Like, and how are you going to make that happen? You know, so it's a cause of tremendous suffering because it brings us at variance to how things actually are, which is ever-changing, moving, conditioned, contingent on many factors. And we know, you know what it's like going into a meeting and somebody is like completely fixated on one resolution to a problem and maybe 50 other possible resolutions are brought up, but it's like can't even be heard because it's got to be that one thing. So that's attachment or fixation. It doesn't serve us. It doesn't serve the goal in whatever way. But again, it doesn't mean that we, you know, dissolve into this puddle of indecision. Of course, we, you know, we want and we're moving and we're creating and we're, you know, somebody's working very, very hard and intensely to make something happen. We have standards of excellence. It's all great, you know, but the clinging is something else. And so that's where metta becomes more like what my friend called metta with an edge. You know, may you be happy by Tuesday and the following 15 ways. You know, and here's your list of changing things that you need to change. And, you know, it's different. And that's why it's the inner enemy, because it can be so easily confused. Compassion, you know, is the second Brahmavihara, and which I used one definition from the teachings, which is the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering, and it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. And there are lots of ways, and the far enemy of compassion is cruelty, which I sometimes think of as such a powerful or overwhelming sense of otherness that what happens to that other doesn't figure as important for us. You know, it's like one thing if you kick a table, if you kick a human being or a puppy and you feel like you're kicking a table, it's really trouble, right? That's the root of a lot of cruelty. You can treat others as though they were nothing, as though it didn't matter, as though they didn't have feelings too, right? But the near enemy of compassion is somewhat complex thing to describe. Sometimes people use the word pity, but while that works, it's not actually the near enemy of compassion in the teachings. It works because people are trying to describe a state that could look like compassion superficially, but is really not. And so pity these days, the word, has a certain element of that hierarchy, you know, like, I'm fine, you're a mess, I'll take pity on you. And that's true, that's not what compassion is meant to reflect. The trouble with using it as the near enemy is that older translations, old-fashioned translations, pity was a very good thing. It didn't have that same sense of, like, being kind of self-righteous or separate. The actual translation of the word is usually sorrow or grief as the near enemy of compassion. But again, it doesn't mean sorrow or grief in the Western psychological sense. That's why I keep saying burnout. Somebody, a translator, a really good scholar actually, suggested despair to me. But I think we know it is burnout. It's like close to compassion. You know, we're in tune, we feel, we're sensitive, we recognize. And yet we don't have the energy to go toward, to see if we can be of help. It's too overwhelming, we're too shattered, we're too exhausted. It's like the definition or the description I gave of the translator in Russia, in the Soviet Union. It's like someone has taken a giant stake and driven it through your heart. It's not really what compassion is in the sense of what we're trying to cultivate, because, I mean, how desperate a state is that, you know? How could you ever go toward to see if you could be of help when you've got this giant stake hanging in your heart? You know, so I actually think burnout, although it's not a formal word, you know, in a certain sense, I think that's actually what the state is. You know, it's close, and yet it's really very, very different. And it's common. You know, it's far from an unknown state. And that's the thing about all these near enemies. They tend to be more familiar to us than the actual Brahmavihara state often is. You know, so that kind of overwhelm is very common. And that's really, I think, the sense of the near enemy of compassion. I'll go back to metta for a moment. The proximate cause, or that launching pad, that is a likely springboard for the state of metta to arise, is twofold, which we've already talked about. One is seeing the good in someone, even if it's like a tiny little fragment in a sea of difficulty. That just creates the conditions so that we can look at the difficulty with a different eye, you know, more compassionate rather than reviling somebody. And it's impossible sometimes. It's not going to happen. And nowhere is the sense that it's good to struggle. Then we just switch to the other reflection, which is all beings want to be happy. And it's because of the force of ignorance, which is rampant, that we continue to do the things that create so much suffering for ourselves and for others. But everybody really does want to be happy. And if you reflect on that, it's just a likelier springboard for having some sense of loving kindness. So I know someone, for example, who tells me she works in some corporation, and she said when people are gathered around a conference table for a meeting, she'll just silently look at everyone one by one, thinking, oh, you want to be happy too, and you want to be happy too, and you want to be happy too, and you want to be happy too. And she said it changes everything. It's kind of interesting. The nearest springboard for, or a very likely springboard for compassion to arise, is recognizing that vulnerability that we all share. That true, we all want to be happy, and true, life is, you know, moving. It's changing. It's it goes by quickly. It changes very quickly. It can change absolutely in one direction or another in a matter of seconds. And here we are. We all share that. So surely that should be a kind of call to wanting to help one another and take care of one another, because we're all in the same predicament in that way. Okay, sympathetic joy is having happiness in the happiness of others, rather than feeling so jealous or envious when we witness their happiness or good fortune. And some of these people ask, or not uncommonly people ask, what if you see somebody like making $1 billion, like despoiling the earth and causing terrible harm to all these people? Are you supposed to be happy for them? And the answer is like, no, you know, like, you know, sympathetic joy isn't about rejecting principles or your own sense of right and wrong and what's important, or it's not being stupid about things. But that's not usually the hindrance to sympathetic joy. It's more envy. jealousy. It's a feeling that happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less is going to be for me. And or I have nothing, and I will forever. And you have everything, and you will forever. So there are a few problems with that. First of all, nothing is forever. Secondly, it is unlikely I have nothing. I might not have much I'm appreciating right now or paying attention to, but it's unlikely I have absolutely nothing. It's also unlikely you have everything. Right? But we just heap these assumptions on top of the situation and we feel so much worse. And then there's that weird thing I was describing earlier where it's almost like you feel like the prize, the praise, the accolade was hitting right towards you. And your friend reached out their hand and grabbed it. So they got it and you didn't. And if they had not done that, you definitely would have won it. And sometimes, of course, we're in direct competition. We're applying for the same job or the same grant. If you get it, I don't. But a lot of times it's not like that. But we feel like it's that way. You took it from me. It's like somebody told me I was dating myself, which of course I am by telling this story. But when I was younger, there was this TV show on called The Millionaire. Anyone remember it? These guys drove around with a $1 million check to give someone. So it's like the feeling like they had my address. And they were coming right there and you kidnapped them. And you stole the check. Now you have it. It's meant to be mine. But life isn't usually like that. We feel that way. You know, so the process of developing sympathetic joy is also the process of like unpeeling those layers of assumption and withholding and, you know, despair and everything we might be feeling to a more realistic sense of how things actually are. You can actually enjoy someone else's happiness. It's not going to take anything away from you. And as the Dalai Lama said some years ago, he said, it only makes sense to develop happiness for the happiness of others because then you increase your own chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. He said, those are very good odds. So what's it like now, like 7 billion or something like that? And you think, you know, my teachers, they would joke, they'd say, you don't even have to get dressed in the morning. You know, you don't have to spend any money. You just like think of someone else's happiness, you're happy. There you are. The far enemy is jealousy or envy. It's a clear opposite. The near enemy is a little tricky. A lot of texts will say giddiness, like being happy for no good reason. I could never kind of make that work. Sylvia can, though. She has some example that actually makes sense. A more meaningful for me description of the near enemy is just comparing. Within the Buddhist psychology, comparing is considered unskillful. That means painful. No matter what conclusion you draw, you might decide you're better than somebody or worse than them or equal to them. And it's still painful because it's restless, it's endless, it's uncertain, constantly seeking, not really knowing who you are and resting in who you are and being happy with who you are, but always seeing, like, how do I exist relative to you? So it's got that same kind of comparing element in a way as sympathetic joy, but it's like the shadow side, you know? It's like we're not comparing for the sake of taking delight in your happiness. We're looking at your happiness to see, is it okay? Am I happier? Who am I, you know? And it just doesn't end. We used to joke, we still joke probably. I don't teach that many intensive retreats anymore, but, you know, let's say you're on an intensive retreat and it's silent. And you have no way of knowing sort of the history of the people sitting right around you. And perhaps you are consumed with the thought, are they better meditators than I am? Perhaps. And we have no way of discussing, you know, their background or anything with them because we're silent. So the only thing you can do is start to measure by what are really irrelevant considerations, like are they sitting still without moving? without shifting posture. So, you know, maybe you come into the hall and the person next to you is already there, and you sit down and just 15 minutes later they move. And you think, oh, good. You know, I'm a much better meditator than they are. And then you start thinking, well, you know, they were already sitting here when I walked in. Maybe they sat through the last sitting all the way through the 45-minute walking period, and even 15 minutes into the second sitting, they're much better than I am. Oh, no. You know, and then you do the person behind you, and you do the person on the other side, and you kind of finished your little neighborhood, and then someone new walks in the room. You go, okay, what about you? You know, and it's endless, right? That's why it's not a state we're seeking to grow and develop. Because it's only suffering. Right? So that makes more sense to me as the near enemy. And the proximate cause is also manifold to some degree. It's seeing someone else's joy. It's even allowing it to be there. And to another degree, there are things we need to shore up, like our own sense of having, right? Rather than feeling so bereft and deficient, and they have so much and I have nothing. That is an impossible state to be cultivating sympathetic joy from. So it's like a gratitude meditation, like what do I have that can make me grateful, help me be grateful? And from that place, not feeling so kind of hollowed out, it's much easier to offer loving kindness and sympathetic joy to somebody else. And then the last of the Brahmaviharas is equanimity. So the far enemy of equanimity is reactivity. It's attachment and aversion, right? It's clinging, holding on, pushing away. The near enemy is indifference. So equanimity is not indifference. It might seem that way sometimes, but when we really take a look, it's not at all like indifference. It's some sense of space, of spaciousness, of openness, of balance, of perspective. And the proximate cause, or the nearest arising condition of equanimity, is wisdom, especially wisdom around you know what I was talking about earlier, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. The ever-changing nature of existence, the fact that it's outside of our control, no one can successfully say, I'll take only pleasure, please, for the next 3 years. Right? It's just not like that. And if we remember, this is the truth of things. This is not our fault. It's just how things are. Then we do have the launching pad for much more balance and wisdom and understanding. I'll also say that, and this is not anything I've ever read anywhere, I made it up, but I make it up out of my own experience and watching the experience of so many people, is that I think like the journey to a Brahmavihara really inevitably takes us through the near enemy. Like if you're trying to really explore and deeply cultivate compassion, you're going to spend some time in that sort of despair. You just are. And with loving kindness, it's going to be attachment. With equanimity, it's going to be indifference. It's not forever, you know. And it's sort of more part of a journey onward. But it happens. It just seems to me inevitable. So that too is not a call for judgment. You know, like, oh, I had equanimity for a minute and a half, and then it became indifference. It's like, yeah, right. You know? I think that can be understood as just a part of a process. Because we don't stay there, you know, we don't get stuck there. And we can also see it for what it is and thus keep moving. So they all kind of work with each other. It's like if you're developing compassion, particularly, you have a pretty acute awareness of suffering. But we can't survive if we're only aware of suffering. If you're developing sympathetic joy, you're also more acutely aware of joy, not only someone else's, but your own, right? Because you need that in order to feel happy for someone else. And that's a pretty important balance. You know, they need one another. Sometimes we have to shift gears. We have to shift focus. You know, you see a little flower struggling through the sidewalk, and you're filled with joy. That's good, you know? And especially if you're engaged in the world in a more compassionate way, and or your family or whatever it is, you know, trying to make a difference. It's like we need those moments, very much so. And it said that equanimity is like the secret ingredient that keeps certainly the first two, loving kindness and compassion, from falling into their near enemy. It's equanimity or wisdom or balance that keeps loving kindness from being attachment. It keeps compassion from being burnout. That's how it functions. So it's got to be there for compassion to be compassion and for loving kindness to be loving kindness. So whether we explicitly are working to develop it or we're just bringing it forth in the role of wisdom, it's always there. Okay, so do you have questions, comments? Yes. How would I distinguish them? How would I distinguish attachment from codependence? It's like the same. I think it's the same. Probably every attached relationship is not codependent, but the way we use the word codependent, I would say it's born of attachment. And that term, codependence, is a useful way for us, usually in contemporary times, to understand why we want equanimity, you know, and that it's not harshness or rejection, but it's something that is really essential, you know, so as not to be codependent and not to be kind of lost. Sure. I highly recommend my book, Loving Kindness, by the way. There's both sets of phrases, and there are alternatives, because you have to find your own in the end, you know, like if the classical phrases are a struggle for you. And that's fine. So, you know, in the book I have different variations, but you can tell, you know, what would be a good variation for you. So loving kindness, there are different sets of phrases that people use. The common ones these days are like, may you be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. Do you want the ones I did in Burma too, or not so much? Okay. Okay, so may you be free from danger. May you be free from mental suffering. May you be free from physical suffering. May you live with ease. So that was what I did in Burma for loving kindness. Compassion would tend to be shorter, and the phrases are different, and the sequence is often different, because the principle is doing it the easiest way possible. So this is someone's guess at what's going to be easiest for you, which is, you know, going back to loving kindness, for example, where we start with ourselves. If it's a struggle, it's not worth starting with yourself. You know, start somewhere else. Start with a benefactor. It's fine. And you have to be there somewhere, you know, but it doesn't have to be right away. And you can have fun with it, too. I had somebody tell me, well, I wait till the very end of the sitting when I'm doing loving kindness for all beings everywhere. And then I pop up like a pop-up ad in the computer, like, me too. You know, you can have fun with it. So, you know, the sequence is also different, and that's just someone's sense, really, most importantly, yours, of what the easiest flow is. Compassion, classically, would have more like one phrase, which would be something like, may you be free of your pain and sorrow. That feels too controlling sometimes for people these days. Remember, this is like gift giving, it's blessing. But still, if it, you know, some people struggle and it's more like, I care about your pain and sorrow, that works for some people, which they will say. Sympathetic joy is, may your happiness and good fortune not diminish. May they increase further and further. And equanimity is like the kicker, because it uses the word karma, which a lot of people have difficulty with, and it's not easy to understand anyway. So this is not meant to be victim blaming, but the phrase is, all beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. All beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. So the perfect example is not wanting to be codependent. You know, you have this friend, you love them, you feel for them. Their life is just going down through their own actions. And in order to have kind of right relationship to their pain, to your efforts, we sort of need that perspective. In the end, it's not mine. You know, I can't make someone else's life up for them. So all beings are the owners of their karma, their happiness and unhappiness. Depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. And really, you don't have to struggle. If the word karma is going to just take you to a bad place, don't use it. You know, there are all kinds of phrases. Things are the way that they are. And sometimes people will combine, say, compassion and equanimity, like, I care about your pain and I can't control it. Something like that. Or I will do what I can and I need to let go in the end. Something. You know, so there's no right or wrong. It just needs to be conveying the right feeling tone for you and setting it out. I actually did all four practices in Burma. Loving kindness for a long time, the others quite briefly. And you're welcome to, you know, do that. Some of these people have a tremendous resonance, say, with compassion and not the others. Or many, many teachers would say, of the four, sympathetic joy tends to be the most difficult. Because, you know, for a lot of us, we would have compassion if we saw the pain in somebody. You know, it's when we don't see pain as pain. Like, we're looking at our own greed, and we're calling it bad and wrong and terrible rather than seeing it as painful. We don't tend to have compassion for ourselves in that experience of greed. But you see it as painful, and then the compassion can more readily be there. So for a lot of us, that's the case, whether with ourselves or others. But to actually be happy for somebody when they're happy, it takes some doing. You know, because you have to dismantle all those assumptions. Like, you know, and there are a lot of them that are, you know, very prevalent. You know, and some of it has to do with having a kind of rock-bottom sense of what we feel will give our life meaning, which might be something like kindness or, you know, and so then all these things happen and you feel jealous and you wish it were you, and then you think, well, do I really want this person to only suffer forever? With very few exceptions. It's no. One of Upandita's, he had these kind of pop quizzes he would do all the time when you're doing metta. So one of them was, like the week or so I did sympathetic joy meditation, he said, okay, imagine you're in a room and there are all these people that you admire in the room with you and you really want them to like you. And they're heaping praise upon this person you really don't like. He said, how do you feel? That was one of his pop quizzes. And I was like, but in all honesty, in doing the practice at that time, when it's cooking, you don't feel that bad. You don't, because what's the alternative? You know, may you never get a compliment your entire life, you know. That's going to help, you know. And so you just don't go there in the same old way. So you can do one for whatever reason and say, well, this is important for me. I'm just going to keep experimenting with this. Or you can do the more common thing. And a lot of that is really just because of the dictates of time. You know, like, again, we all teach according to our own minds. And I know with my mind, if I had 7 days and I was trying to get through 4 sets of phrases, it would be too much for me. You know, I would rather, in that shorter period of time, do just the loving kindness and bring in the forces of the other Brahmaviharas through the recipients. You know, that friend who's having surgery. You know, that friend who's getting an award. It does the same thing. Yes. Okay, so the question was, would it be accurate to think of the savior complex as a near enemy of compassion? So if you go back to what I was talking about, the movement between empathy and compassion, there are many responses we can have to a genuine and essential moment of empathy that are not compassion. So you could talk about any of them as being a part of a complex of these alternative reactions. That are not compassion, as part of a complex that, taken together, are part of the near enemy. So what did I talk about? I talked about blaming, right? That faraway psychotherapist who's blaming all their clients. Fear. Exhaustion or devastation, that's like the burnout. Feeling I am going to be the one who's going to save you, which is what you're talking about. Or we can have the compassionate response, the movement toward, to see if we can be of help. And for a while, I was trying to train myself out of using the term compassion and calling it the compassionate response, but it didn't work. But that's what it really is. It's one possible response. The relationship between patience and equanimity. Well, I think patience is one of the consequences of equanimity, right? That we just have a different relationship to what is in front of us because we know it's part of a bigger picture. We may not know what the bigger picture is, but we really believe it's there. And so and sometimes I use the illustration of in Tibetan Buddhist teaching, there's a meditation instruction that I don't tend to use as a meditation instruction. I tend to use more in this context. And the instruction is to be with the thoughts and feelings that arise in your mind as though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. So be with the thoughts and feelings that arise in your mind as though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. So what does that imply? You're quite an elderly person. You've lived a life. You've seen a lot. You've probably had to let go of a lot. You have a way different perspective on things. And there this little kid, like this 2-year-old's freaking out because they broke a shovel. You know, you see it in a different way. You don't, on the one hand, you're not cold and mean. You don't go up and say, kid, it's just a shovel, you know. Wait till you have a real problem, like, you know, sciatica or something, you know. It's not like that. But you're also, you know what else you don't do? You don't fall down on the ground sobbing either. Because you know what? Shovels break. It's a part of life. So you've got both, like tenderness and caring and kindness and a bigger picture. So you're not freaked out. And as I said, I don't tend to use it as an instruction. I use it in this context. You know, like, I know I, as an individual, as a person, if I was seeking help from somebody, and I told them my very sad story, and they fell down on the ground sobbing, I think, oh, my God, you know, like, there's no hope at all, you know. It would be terrifying to me. On the other hand, I don't want somebody to say, that's just a shovel, you know, like, I want both. I want the kindness and the tenderness and the presence, and I want that sense, even if it's not verbal, I want that sense of something bigger, you know, something more open, something not so defined. by the circumstances. And I think we do want both. Somebody told me a story, it's a really terrible story. It had a good ending, but because he told it to me, that's why it's a good ending. He was in a swimming pool somewhere and he had a panic attack and he thought he was having a heart attack. So he called 911. And the dispatcher had like a total meltdown, like, oh my God. So Chris, then he realized he was having a heart attack. And he got more and more and more agitated. And I thought, oh, spare me, you know, like, we don't want that, you know, it's actually not that helpful. But we don't want the coldness either, you know, we want like real kindness and something more open. You know, not, and that's like the equanimity part. It's like, okay, I don't know what the bigger picture is, but there's a bigger picture, right, than what's right in front of me. And it's a lot of patience. Compassion implies separation. Yeah, I'm having a hard time hearing you, but the people right around you heard you, so what are they? Lack of self-compassion implies what? From what?
From each other.
Yeah, that's true. I think, so the comment was the lack of, you have such a nice soft voice. Not like me, New Yorker, you know. Lack of self-compassion implies a separation from one another. I think that's true. Because a lack of self-compassion, ironically enough, is also a kind of self-absorption. You know, like the things we think are narcissistic or self-preoccupied are usually not, like self-compassion or caring about ourselves. And the things we think are really great are like judging ourselves and feeling, you know, I'll never be able to change. That's usually more self-preoccupied than not. Kristen Neff did a brilliant system, you know, of sort of elucidating self-compassion out of loving kindness teachings, I must say. And, you know, I forget the three qualities of self-compassion. One is mindfulness, like to know what you're feeling. One is what she calls common humanity. It's realizing, oh yeah, I made a mistake. People make mistakes. This is part of the human condition. And this, you know, it's in contrast, self-compassion is in contrast to self-esteem, you know, which we also need, you know, like we don't spend enough time, or we spend more time usually thinking about our flaws and our faults than feeling joy and like, oh, I learned a new thing today. You know, I learned how to pronounce this word. I never learned a new language. I learned how to play tennis, whatever it is. You know, we don't usually give that much airtime, and we could, and it would be better if we did. But self-compassion, in contrast, doesn't come up when we learned how to play tennis. It comes up when we made a mistake, when we blew it in some way. You know, we sat down to feel the breath, and, you know, an hour and a half of sleep later, we wake up and go, oh, that wasn't much of a sitting. You know, that's when we need self-compassion, is when things have not gone according to our dream. You know, we're not accomplishing greatly in that moment. And common humanity is a big part of it, and realizing that this is a part of life. Everybody experiences this. We can have such perfectionistic models, internally and externally. It's like that same thought that says you have everything and you will forever. That is so unlikely, right? But we ascribe perfection, and we don't even want perfection. I mean, if we really look, perfection is the most static state there is. It lasts like a second and a half of stillness. You know, like a fruit is perfect, and it's starting to decay. Or I just bought a new car. Many of you know that from those stories. You know my new car story? Oh, new people, it's so exciting. Everyone else don't listen. So, the major story I tell is not about perfection because it wasn't quite there, but I have other stories, you know, like I needed a new car. My car lives in Massachusetts, where I actually literally live, although I have an apartment in New York. And it was just getting old, you know. I loved that car. And it was so old, though, it had like a tape player in it, you know, for cassettes. And it was breaking down, which was really the problem. You know, every time I'd go home and I'd have to drive somewhere, I never knew if it was going to make it. So I was persuaded to get a new car, and I needed a four-wheel drive because I have a driveway up to my house. It's treacherous. So it took a long, 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 long time, very patient friends helping me buy this car because a number of different reasons. I wasn't always there, and I would test drive all these things, and I didn't like them. And I also don't know how to drive a modern car. Like, you know, I was sitting in a car, and the salesman was literally yelling at me because I didn't know how to, like, press the button and step on the brake to start the car. I wanted a key, you know. And he literally was yelling at me, step on the brake. And I say, well, stepping on the brake stops it. Why does it start it, you know? Like, and to this day, I can't look at a little screen to go back. I have to turn my head. Anyway, so it was a really troublesome process. It was lengthy. So finally, I chose a car, and the salesman said to me, I'm certain we can get your first choice of color because we're going to look up and down the East Coast, but give me two choices just in case, you know. So my first choice was mulberry. It's the color of your shawl. It's like the color of Tibetan Buddhist robes. It's like this burgundy. And I really wanted this mulberry car. The second choice, because I had to give him one, was this kind of electric blue, like a lapis blue. And that also had certain Dharma associations for me. It's the color of the medicine Buddha in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a very healing color. And I usually love that color, but I had my heart set on the mulberry. So the weeks went by, and the day came when I heard the car was going to be delivered. And they delivered the car, and it was blue. And I couldn't believe it. I was so disappointed. Even though in other circumstances, I actually love that color. And if you had asked me, this is a story about attachment, if you had asked me, like, for the first 2 weeks what the color of my car was, I would have said, not mulberry. That's the name of the color. So that's an example of attachment. But anyway, even given that, which was a big flaw, you know, the car was unmarred for, I don't know, a day. You know, and then it got a scratch, and then it was like, oh no, you know. But that's life. Nothing is perfect and solid and unchanging, and we don't want it to be. You know, everything is moving and flowing and going on and changing, and that includes flaws and mars and having to start over and pick yourself up again. But it's not just me, it's everybody. And that's one of the most crucial aspects of her system of describing what self-compassion is. I forget the third. Maybe it's, is it, hmm? Kindness, thank you. Kindness. Sometimes I remember it, sometimes I forget it. So mindfulness, common humanity, and kindness. Okay, forgiveness in relation to loving kindness. I never get away with not talking about forgiveness, and I always try. I try only in the sense that, or motivated by the word being so complex and so many people having a different view of what it must mean. Like my friend Sylvia Boorstein would say, forgiveness is not amnesia. You know, it doesn't mean we wipe out what happened and say it didn't matter. Maybe it does matter quite a lot. But often we think it has to be amnesia, whether we're trying to forgive ourselves or forgive someone else. It has much more, and also I feel reluctant sometimes to use the word, bless you, because I feel like I've seen many instances of people doing remarkable acts of what I would call forgiveness, and not uncommonly in describing them, they would end by saying, but I'll never forgive them. And I think, what does that mean? You know, it means something else to you than it means to me. So, for example, in one retreat, there was co-teaching. It was clear that somebody in the retreat was in a lot of physical distress. They couldn't really sit still. And then my co-teacher gave a talk or led a sitting on forgiveness, which he didn't like at all, this guy. So he came up to complain to me about her. And he told the story about being in a terrorist attack and his body being trashed and still. And, you know, so he was in a lot of physical pain all the time. And then he said, I'll never forgive them. But what I've learned is absolutely essential is to learn to stop hating. And I thought, you know what? I'll take that. That sounds kind of remarkable to me. In those circumstances, especially, if you don't want to call it forgiveness, don't call it forgiveness, you know. So the first question is really, what do you mean by forgiveness? And for people who really think about it deeply, it's very personal. And a lot of it seems to have to do with, if you're trying to forgive someone else or moving in that direction, it's, first of all, it's a lot like loving kindness in that it doesn't mandate an action. It doesn't mean you have to have Thanksgiving dinner together, you know, or ever speak to them. But it's the heart space of being free. You know, not feeling so much of your life energy is being captured by someone else's actions. It's a little like my friend who I described as saying, after one of his great obsessive bouts, I let that guy live rent-free in my brain for too long. You know, when you want to be free of that, the process of disentangling is what we often call forgiveness. But it's more like disentangling. It's recapturing your energy. It's not saying that what happened was okay. Sometimes in less kind of grievous instances, you know, like not extreme pain or, you know, terrible pain, but kind of more day-to-day slights and, you know, misunderstandings and things. There's actually this ritual in Buddhist monasticism of asking and extending forgiveness, which is a way of saying goodbye. So, you know, we talk often about 1984, which is getting to be some years ago, when this Burmese teacher, Upandita, came to the Insight Meditation Society and taught that three-month retreat. And he was so intense and fierce and demanding a teacher. And I was sitting that retreat, and he and I got along really well. But I could also tell there was a lot of stuff happening. Like the rules for the monks and where they sleep are very strict, and they kept putting them in different places. And why is he sleeping there now? And then he's sleeping there. And then at one point they built a wall in this corridor out of brick, and then they took it down. And I was like, so I could tell, you know, there was a lot going on. They were having a very difficult time accommodating his vows, basically. And on the other side, you know, he had never been to America before. And as I said, you know, it's a culture where you can always ask questions. It's not like that's never disallowed, ever. But it is a culture of respect. You know, he was so unused to saying something and having someone say, I don't believe that, or show me why. And he was like, whoa, you know. So I could just tell there were all these strains, you know, on both sides. So the day came when he was ending the retreat, and he kept silence. He kept us in silence till that day, you know. And he got up on the platform and he closed the retreat by saying, if I have hurt or harmed you knowingly or unknowingly, I ask your forgiveness. And if you have hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. And it was actually a tremendous moment for me, because even though we had personally had a great relationship, I felt like this huge sense of relief. It was like, oh, I don't have to wonder if I would have run into you again you're going to look at me and think, you're the one who started that center where they don't even know how to treat a Buddhist monk. And I wouldn't have to look at you and think, oh, you're the one who came to the West without being prepared for what you're going to find. It's like we could just start anew. And in fact, that's what happened. I went to Burma the following year, and he was my metta teacher, you know, which is why we're all sitting here now. You know, so, and again, it's, you know, it's not something I'm suggesting for, like, awful, you know, instances, but you think about the day-to-day accumulation of, you know, resentments and, you know, dislike and the way you fix people. Oh, you're only the one who's, you know, this, rather than, oh, that happened, but you're bigger than that. And it's actually an interesting and powerful practice. You know, Yeah, and then there's self-forgiveness, too. It's just, and sometimes people who use that classical formula would add that on. You know, if you have hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, or if you weren't sitting in front of people, if anyone has hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive them. If I've hurt or harmed anyone knowingly or unknowingly, I ask their forgiveness. And if I have hurt someone, I ask, you know, I am working to... I'm going to end up writing a book on forgiveness. I know it. You know, I so do not want to do that. Like, that'll be book number 12. I actually don't like the number 11 that much, so. I think, I'm going to have to write a 12. Yes. Bliss. What do you mean by bliss? Mm-hmm. Okay, so how does bliss work with equanimity? I think there are two aspects to looking at any feeling state like that. Or there are two ways we can look, not really two aspects. One is when it's the object of what we're feeling, it's what we're looking at, what we're observing. And the other, when it's a part of how we're observing. You know, so let's say we have a pleasant state and we're looking at how good it feels. And certainly the possibility exists as we get concentrated to feel extraordinary states of bliss, which are remarkable because, again, you're not spending any money, you know, you're not... staying up late necessarily, you're not like in a frenzy trying to like buy something before the sale ends, you know, it's like it's all within, and that's like an amazing experience, and they're available, those states. But a state, and again, this is just within the Buddhist framework, you know, Hindus would use the word bliss very differently, and even Tibetans would use the word differently than Burmese, but say from the Burmese perspective, the bliss or any extraordinary experience is just an experience, which means it'll change. So if you cling to that, you're in trouble. If you can experience it as it is and enjoy it and be enlivened by it, that's great. But once you start clinging to anything, you're going to suffer. And so... they also would make a distinction between a path of practice that largely centers on concentration, that gathering of our energy, that quick return to the stable object, and a practice that's more centered on mindfulness, where we may be looking at a variety of objects, you know, first the breath, then a sensation, then anger, then joy. But noticing how they're all changing, right? So that's an insight practice. So the kind of extraordinary feeling states we associate with extraordinary meditation are more from concentration. But concentration is also usually, it tends to be more fragile than some of the other things we develop because it's sort of environmentally dependent. You know, so... they would use an example like, let's say you're sitting in New York City, you're meditating in your living room, and you start to feel this extraordinary bliss arise. Your body feels amazing. Your mind is like a mirror. You know, all you see is white light. And you're enjoying it quite a lot. And then a siren goes by, and it's all gone. You know, and you think, what's that? Why do I live here? This is terrible. I've got to move into the country. I'll never get enlightened if I move into the country. And they say you can be mindful of the bliss, mindful of the sound, mindful of your distress. Your mindfulness can actually be unbroken as you go up and you go down, but the concentration is dispersed with getting upset about the siren. So, and my Tibetan teacher, Sonny Rinpoche, he's very funny. He's like a great mimic. So, of course, the people he's mimicking is us. So he'll say, let's say you're sitting in your living room and all that happens and you think, I'm going to have to move into my closet for my meditation. So maybe it's your only closet in New York, doesn't matter. You pull all your stuff out, you create an altar, you know, and you've got like a zabutan, you've got an altar, and you've got an incense burner, and you go and you sit down and you're feeling this extraordinary state, and you realize, oh no, I can hear the water in the pipes, I can hear the plumbing. This isn't going to work. So then you go out and you buy some of those ear things they wear on the airport tarmac, you know. So then you're sitting in your closet afraid of a sound, you know. And before you sit down, you like smooth everything out so nothing's rubbing and nothing's irritating. And you're sitting there and it's just amazing. You've got your things on, you know, and you're burning the incense. And then you have a memory that's really distressing. Since you can't pluck out your brain, you know, that's why they kind of emphasize mindfulness meditation, because it can accompany you as a strength through all those different circumstances. And I don't think meditation ultimately is about making our life smaller, so we have to live in the closet, you know, with our earmuffs on. Not earmuffs, you know what I mean, whatever they are. So that's bliss or joy or pleasure or an extraordinary state of consciousness as an object. There's also elements of consciousness in pure looking that are different. You know, incredible sense of freedom and spaciousness and openness and connection. And it's not from what's happening, it's from how we're looking at what's happening. So it's part of the awareness itself. And that's what Tibetans would call bliss, you know, as part of the awareness itself. And that's what we work on, not on trying to get and keep some other state, even if it's an internal state. It's not going to last. It never lasts. But we can keep refining how we're looking. You know, so it's that much more present and immediate and balanced and so on. And then it's a whole other way of being, no matter what's going on, whether you're looking at knee pain or you're looking at sorrow or you're looking at this tremendous refined state of consciousness. It's the refinement of how we look that brings us those states. So I would probably tend to refer to bliss more as that than as the object, although the object is attainable, it really is. You know, it's not like there's no way to get there. It's just we never can stay there. So how much time do you want to spend, you know, trying to cultivate a state of consciousness that'll change? Just like your car gets marred, you know, something else happens. That's Yeah. I mean, I think the question was about that complex equanimity phrase, all beings are the owners of their karma, their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. And what about these situations where that doesn't seem to be true? It's someone else's actions that's really responsible for someone's misery, you know? And I could see why it made you nervous, because it's so hard to understand. And even the belief in karma, you know, is embedded in a culture where they believe in rebirth and they believe in many lives. And almost the best way to understand someone's unfathomable karma needs that perspective. And it's also understanding or believing that one of the ways that teaching is used is to realize that, or to conjecture, I mean, you don't realize because you don't know, but that they would say that time is beginningless. The universe has no beginning. So in the course of this beginningless universe, we have all done everything. Like those of us sitting here in this room right now have all done everything. We've, even just to one another. You know, we've helped one another and killed one another and saved one another. And so I've often thought from that perspective, the single most illogical feeling we could have is one of self-righteousness. You know, like I, who am so perfect, I'm watching you do that terrible thing down there, which I could never do, because guess what? You've done it. So it's used more in ways like that. In a situation like where you described, like at the border, they would say the people carrying it out are creating terrible karma for themselves. And you would want to take very strong action to try to stop it, even for their sake. You know, it's just how they design the universe, is that the compassion for the perpetrator can be as strong a motivation as vengefulness or despising them in some way. And but it's not like, you know, the people are bad and that's why they are suffering in that way, because we've all done everything and we all, it's just like it's their turn, which is terrible. You know, someday it'll be our turn and we won't like that very much, so let's see if we can change how things are done. What was revolutionary about the Buddha's teaching, a couple of things sociologically, was that morality in his time was commonly held, not by everybody, but there were common systems that were very tied into the caste system. And so what was right and appropriate and moral for, say, a Brahmin male was not for a Brahmin female. Or what was right for Brahmin male, like mediating with the divine or reading scripture, was not appropriate